We always knew for a while back, long back, that there were feedbacks on it, but what we've seen recently is climate forcing of stratospheric circulation. The climate, the warming climate has basically sort of sped up the stratosphere, goes to the long, it can sort of turn over faster. That is good for us because it destroys more nitric acid than it used to, nitrous acid than it used to. And so what I've found recently by looking at the satellite data and is that it's actually decreasing. So our lifetime is decreasing, which means the loss is increasing faster than how much we put up there. So we're finding out that the lifetime is dropping about 2% per decade, and that doesn't seem like much, but if you add it up over the century, it significantly affects the projections. Now, the one thing that has not really been put into any of the assessments, and the more recent paper that's out this week was interesting because we finally compared it and showed that the models were predicting a more vigorous circulation, but they had not yet calculated what it did to N2O. We could see the effect on N2O for the last 20 years, and the climate models seem to predict that with any reasonable climate change, this circulation in the stratosphere will increase again and again. So the decrease in lifetime and hence the faster loss of N2O appears to be a fairly solid result, and it will, my estimate is that after work looking at the climate models for circulation, is that it will happen through the century.
We get reliable data on the amount of nitrous oxide from something called the Microwave Limb Sounder Satellite. What is that?
So the Microwave Limb Sounder is a fascinating satellite. It looks in the microwave. So instead of having big telescope and lenses, it has microwave horns, like you think of. The wavelengths are out, at centimeter long, very long wavelengths, and they measure the rotation of the molecule. And so a guy named Joe Waters at JPL sort of pioneered this work long ago. And it's an amazingly stable instrument. It's been running for over 20 years. Very little degradation in general. And it's been delivering this wonderful, sort of constantly scanning the stratosphere for nitrous oxide. It also measures many other species, including ozone, temperature, as well as other interesting chemicals that we're interested in. It's about to die. And the instrument, the whole satellite platform has to die because it can't really be maintained in orbit and pointing in the right direction. So we've got maybe 1 or 2 years left. And right now there's no effort, there's no interest in doing a repeat of this. Probably because this is sort of a matter of, NASA wants to do something that's new and interesting on science. They don't want to just keep monitoring it. And so the question would be, what needs to be done? Well, one of the things, solution would be you could wait 10 years and then put up an instrument because this is a slow change over the century. So I don't really care if we monitor it every year. But we should eventually want to go back and look at nitrous oxide in the stratosphere probably another couple of decades, find out what's happening. And there may be other ways to check on stratospheric circulation.
Your latest paper is Projecting Nitrous Oxide Over the 21st Century, Uncertainty Related to Stratospheric Loss. That was just published in the top journal PNAS on February 2nd, 2026. To understand the problem, we need to grasp a kind of paradox. As the lower atmosphere warms, the upper layer or stratosphere gets colder. Why is that?
Well, that's because it's all, in this case, it's really CO2. What CO2 is an interesting molecule. It traps infrared radiation, and it emits radiation. So one of the things CO2 can do is it provides an antenna for the atmosphere to cool. If you want to think about it, it provides a way for the atmosphere to cool and radiate. But it also traps stuff. So in the lower atmosphere where we are in the troposphere, in the top of the troposphere, CO2 is capturing all the radiation leaving the Earth that we need to cool the planet. And it sends half of it back down and spends more up. Effectively, it sort of traps it and makes it much harder for the planet to cool. In the stratosphere, which is very, very thin, and there's not much radiation is going through it, but it's hard to capture it there. What the CO2 does is it actually enables the atmosphere to cool, as it can radiate directly to space, which is very cold, about 3 degrees Kelvin. And so the stratosphere has been cooling for the last 20 years due to CO2, and the troposphere has been warming also due to CO2 and the other greenhouse gases. And so this creates a fairly large gradient between lower and above, and it's changing both the way waves propagate in the stratosphere and the way they change the circulation. And it's the combination of the two between a warmer troposphere and different storms in circulation down there changes the stratospheric circulation, which is what I was looking at, which appears that stratospheric circulation is turning over faster and faster. The faster turnover, means it pops nitrous oxide up higher and higher in the stratosphere where it gets destroyed faster.
Yes, you were dealing with something called the Brewer-Dobson circulation and its role in the availability of nitrous oxide as the world warms. What is that circulation and what's that got to do with how much gas is left up there?
Okay, so the Brewer-Dobson circulation stratosphere was identified by two scientists, Brewer and Dobson, looking at things. They actually had measurements in the lower stratosphere of things like helium, species like helium and water vapor, and they deduced looking at the distributions and the subtlety, they actually deduced that there was a circulation where the stratospheric air went up in the tropics and came down at high latitudes, mid-latitudes. And this is called the Brewer-Dobson name for those two scientists from the 1930s and 40s. They also, in that sense, has been the core. What we've done since then, people who do stratospheric dynamical work, like doing the weather in the stratosphere, have done a lot of work on waves and propagation and understanding this. Actually, we see that the column of air from the troposphere, which is the source of N2O, bulk of it, gets sent up in the tropics and then splits out to the higher latitudes. In the tropics is where the most intense ultraviolet is, and so the faster and higher up you move it, the more rapidly it's destroyed. And so what we've been seeing lately is a speed-up of the circulation overall, and the speed-up of circulation means you're taking up gases like chlorofluorocarbons and nitrous oxide and even methane up to higher altitudes where they're more rapidly destroyed.
Excess nitrous oxide is doubly harmful in the atmosphere. Yes, it is a powerful warming gas, but nitrous oxide also leads to more destruction of the ozone layer that protects us from harmful radiation. The chemistry is pretty involved, but Michael Prather, can you help us understand why nitrous oxide damages ozone?
So nitrous oxide is one of the source gases of other chemical radicals that it leaves behind in the stratosphere. In the same way that the chlorofluorocarbons were the source gas for chlorine radicals, nitrous oxide, when it gets broken up by sunlight, releases NO, nitric oxide. And NO and NO circulates with ozone back and forth, the same way that chlorine atoms circulate with ozone back and forth to basically catalytically destroy it. So they run chemical cycles around anywhere from 25 to 50 kilometers in the stratosphere that chew up ozone more rapidly than would be natural. And so we've been worried, of course, about chlorofluorocarbon depletion because that releases chlorine atoms that do it. And we've always been also worried about the nitrous oxide. And so right now, our threat to stratospheric ozone is not CFCs because the Montreal Protocol has controlled those gases. But it's really right now, it's the N2O that we've done nothing to control it all, and it appears to be very difficult to control it based upon empirical evidence. That is, what's happened to N2O in the real world and what we think we're doing to it. A bit of an optimism that we can reduce emissions on nitrous oxide, and I think the evidence has shown that we really can't.
Would that change your calculations? I mean, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that you used a kind of fixed emission rate, maybe based on human-induced emissions right now, rather than trying to figure out what humans will do with emissions. Is that how you did approach it?
Well, for the projections, what I took was the IPCC has a group called, generates SSP, Shared Socioeconomic Pathways, emissions for, future types of worlds. The types include issues of technology, sharing governance, environmental issues, and so on. And they have a range of scenarios that are used for the climate assessment. And so these scenarios are the ones we'd also use for the ozone assessment. And they have a range of predictions depending upon what we think what we're doing for the N2O emissions. The emissions are then mapped onto a model, which in this case has a fixed lifetime, unlike the one that I just made, has a fixed lifetime, and then you project nitrous oxide into the future out to 2100 or so. If you look at what's really happening to nitrous oxide, it's been increasing regularly, and the increase is even getting faster every year. And so we've been accelerating the increase in the atmosphere. And what I did was take that increase and calculate what the flux would have to be. And then I took that flux and ran it through my model with a changing lifetime and showed what it does to our projections of nitrous oxide. So the goal is there are lots of people working on reducing nitrous oxide emissions, and almost all these scenarios have reductions in nitrous oxide because we want to get rid of it because of climate gas. Now, problem is, if you look at what's happened and the historical record, it's always well above these projections. And so it's a very interesting game that there's an optimism that exists, and the people who build the scenarios, that there's a possibility of control. And just look, from what we've seen in the atmosphere, there appears to be yet no will or no ability to control the emissions.
In our previous interview in October 2024, you told us methane stays in the atmosphere longer than we thought, and that's kind of bad news. Now, this is better news for nitrous oxide. Why are you investigating these gases, and what still needs to be done?
That's interesting. You're right. So my main interest in the science I work on is understanding the lifetime and the sort of chemical cycle, the transport, and what really controls the sort of chemistry and whatever that it controls the lifetimes of these gases, because that controls their buildup. And so a lot of people work on emissions of them, where they're coming from, what's happening. And I tend to work on the atmosphere and the chemistry. And so when I started working on the methane one, I found out that there are more likely ways to reduce it. We might have a faster loss of methane, okay, which would be good, and that might work or not. But the N2O one, I found the opposite by looking at the observations of N2O. The methane one, we had to deal with the best chemistry we had, and I wasn't really paying too much attention to the observations of methane for lifetime. But with N2O, we have enough measurements in the stratosphere, we can actually calculate the lifetime directly from the mix of abundances that are measured by the MLS satellite.
From the University of California, we've been speaking with distinguished Professor Michael Prather. He is lead author of the new paper, Projecting Nitrous Oxide Over the 21st Century, Uncertainty Related to Stratospheric Loss, published in PNAS. Find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Michael, thank you for sharing this new science with us.
Thanks, Alex. Delighted to talk to you.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Worried about climate tipping points? According to new science, the tipping points for macroalgae blooms occurred around 2010. What happens to seaweed and plankton as we heat up the ocean? Should we care? Our first big look at the state of world algae was published in Nature Communications in December 2025. The title kind of gives away the plot. Global floating algae blooms are expanding. Our guest, Dr. Brian Barnes, is a co-author and assistant research professor at the College of Marine Science, University of South Florida. From St. Petersburg, Brian Barnes, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Let's begin with the very basics. What is algae?
Algae is a pretty broad term that encompasses a whole lot of different life, including things that are as small as a single cell that can only be viewed under a microscope, and as large as something that can grow into, something you can see with your hands, and even it makes huge ecosystems that impact our entire Earth. But broadly, they're similar to plants, but just on a different tree.
There's a difference between macroalgae. We can see it in microalgae, which we can't. Is your study about one or the other of those?
It's about both.
Okay. And I note that the word seaweed includes so many plants. I mean, it's kelp, it's nori, it's dulse, wrack, spirulina, sea moss. There's so many. Which seaweed has been the focus around Florida?
Right. So all of those individual species that you listed are different types of algae. They're brown algae, they're red algae, and different categories within algae. In the state of Florida, what we're most interested in right now is sargassum, which is a type of brown macroalgae, and it floats at the surface of the water. And recently, as part of one of the blooms that we describe in this paper, it's the abundance, the footprint, the size, and the amount of sargassum that impacts the Atlantic Ocean and Florida specifically are increasing.
Well, there's been a big patch of sargassum in the Sargasso Sea. I mean, explorers found it. It seems to have escaped, though, because it invaded popular Mexican beaches in 2015, 2018, 2022, and 2025. It's a smelly mess. Is this connected to increases found in your paper?
Yes, and no, actually. So the story of sargassum in the Atlantic Ocean is kind of complex in the last couple of years. So you are correct that the first records we have of sargassum were from the original transatlantic travelers, Columbus and the like, who noted this this habitat, this floating macroalgae in the middle of what he called the Sargasso Sea. It's named for the sargassum. so the sargassum there has been there for a long time. There are a lot of little critters that live in and amongst it. There are, you know, invertebrates, little shrimps and crabs and things that even use mimicry to look like the sargassum so that they can kind of blend in with this environment. So they're huge. They're called golden floating rainforest sometimes. They're just huge places of life and abundance in kind of a, which generally the open ocean is thought to not have a whole lot going on. Whether or not that's a fair characterization, it's true that sargassum mats would be where you would find an abundance of life in the ocean. So with that long history, we found that somewhere around 2011, we've noticed that there was a new footprint. Essentially, the sargassum from the Sargasso Sea stopped being just in the Sargasso Sea, and it instead started to form a new bloom, a new footprint, more in the tropical area. So instead of think between, you know, North America and Europe, this is between Central America and Africa. So a little bit farther south, and this bloom is the one that impacts the Mexican coast, all of the islands in the Caribbean, and Florida as well. And this bloom is really the one that's causing the tourism and other issues. And we have no recorded history of sargassum coming ashore in those areas in these high abundances in all of recorded history. So this is a new phenomenon for the Central Atlantic area. While this is happening, one other thing that we've noticed, and we just published a paper on this last month, is that Sargasso Sea sargassum, the one that had been there for 400 at least years, seems to have declined quite a bit. So while we've got this this increase, this major increase in sargassum in the tropical Atlantic, that original population, the Sargasso Sea sargassum, has declined somewhere around 90% over the last 10 years.
So longtime marine watchers thought we were seeing more seaweed in recent decades, but we really didn't know what is happening with macroalgae globally until this new paper?
Yeah, that's correct. We had hints of little pieces of this, a story of this here happening, and then, of course, there's been all of this news coverage on sargassum, the huge inundations and so forth that are part of the Great Atlantic Sargassum Belt. So we have little pieces of stories, but this study is the first one that really puts that all together, both with the macroalgae and the microalgae, to tell kind of a comprehensive story from what you can see from satellites.
The new paper on global algae is led by Dr. Lynn Key from the NOAA Center for Satellite Applications and Research. And for the layman, Brian Barnes, how did your team determine algae changes at the global level?
Right. So we have, we'll call them weather satellites, but essentially there are cameras that are passing, orbiting every day, looking down on the oceans, and they've been doing so for the last 25, 30 years, at least this one particular sensor that we've used here. So it's looking down on the oceans, collecting, we'll call them images, but it's got a lot more information than simple what you would collect with a camera. But from this, we can we've developed some artificial intelligence and machine learning approaches that kind of quickly read in that satellite information and detect very fast, very quickly, whether or not there is floating algae. And you do that over the million or so images that have been collected over the last 25 years, and you can start to build up this picture not only of what's happening in space, but in time.
And where did you find the largest expansion of algae blooms? I mean, is it only in the Western Atlantic? Is it happening over in the Pacific?
Yes, it's happening somewhere over about 12% of the total global ocean surface area, and that includes the Atlantic. We've talked a little bit about that. It includes the Indian Ocean, some in the Pacific, including around Hawaii and then east of Australia, and pretty much throughout the oceans with the exception of the Southern Ocean and the Arctic Ocean. Those are the only two places where we really don't have any indication that there's these large changes.
What changed around 2010, and why call it a tipping point?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and I don't necessarily have a satisfactory answer. It's not likely that there is a single event that caused, you know, both an increase in macroalgae in the South China Sea and similarly at the same time a new bloom forming of sargassum in the Atlantic Sea. There's just not really a lot of connection there. But likely the overall global picture is just becoming more suitable for these macroalgae blooms. So just like with any plant, an algae just needs the right things to grow. It needs the fertilizer, it needs a seed population, it needs the right temperature and light regime. And once you have those, then you will start to have a bloom. So essentially the conditions became right, and then the seed populations, be it an expansion of the sargassum footprint or something else causing some of these other, starting these other blooms, it just creates the conditions where the blooms can flourish.
And we've had many remarkable marine heat waves appearing in world oceans. Do we know how global warming, is it a significant factor in promoting these bigger floating algae blooms?
Yes and no. I'll speak mostly about sargassum because I work with that more than some of these other blooms, but as with anything, there's a temperature tolerance. There's a tolerance for where it will grow, and then there's a tolerance for what it can survive. You know, you may warm up to the point that you're now into a condition whereby you're having a longer potential growing season because the water is just warmer. But if you have too much of a heat wave, then you may end up tipping on the other side of that scale, into which you see declines in either the ability to grow or just in the ability to survive.
You mentioned that some of the research was done by satellite, and I can see how you could see the big floating mats, but how could you measure locations and amounts of microalgae, things that we can't see without a microscope, from the distance of space?
Yeah, so the microalgae that we look at, I'll characterize them into two different groups here. You know, there's an entire field of satellite oceanography called ocean color. And basically, that's looking at the ocean to see what color it is. And you can infer from the color. If the water is green, then there's chlorophyll in the water, very basically. So that is one way that we're able to tell about chlorophyll microscopic algae from 700 kilometers in the air. You can see the change in the color of the water. But for these types of features, we're actually looking at things that are floating on the surface. And there is one particular measurement that the satellite is recording that plants and algae and vegetation in general gives us a very bright signal in this, it's called a near-infrared band. So we can pick it up very strongly against the contrast of background water, where you have none of this deep red light comes up from the ocean, but it reflects very strongly from microalgae. So a long way to say this, from the satellite perspective, we can pick up, even if an individual satellite picture has something like 0.2% coverage by a floating matter, we can pick it up from a satellite.
I've read that microalgae and macroalgae produce about 40% of the Earth's oxygen supply, so isn't more algae at sea a good thing?
Yeah, it can be. There's been a lot of research done on using the growth of algae, microalgae, macroalgae in the oceans, both to generate oxygen but also to draw down CO2. So generally, yes, we think that generating oxygen, drawing down CO2 are both good things, especially in our changing climate. Yes, there has been a lot of evidence, or a lot of research into plants, macroalgae, microalgae as producing oxygen and drawing down CO2. And there's been a lot of work to try and create conditions that would draw down CO2 by fertilizing the ocean with nutrients and so forth.
In the why should we worry department, I was startled to find out that big blooms of sea plants can dramatically change the whole climate of the Earth. Tell us about the Azolla event 49 million years ago.
Yeah, the Azolla event is actually a really interesting phenomenon that happened. So you have to, taking yourself back 49 million years ago, the world was a little bit different. The continents weren't exactly where they are now. But basically, the way they found this is they were doing some cores, they were digging into the mud, essentially, in the Arctic Ocean. And they found that there were some freshwater tropical plants there, essentially. And the remains of these plants lasted over 800,000 years. So there was a long time period where you had a tropical freshwater plant growing in the Arctic Ocean. And basically the thought is these plants, conditions, just like we discussed, when you have the right conditions for plants to grow, they will grow. And as we also mentioned, when plants die, they can draw down carbon dioxide. So when they die, their skeletons fall, and they also take their CO2 that they've built up, their plant matter, with them. So the broad thought is that the conditions were right 49 million years ago, that this plant, this singular tropical freshwater plant, was able to grow, and it flourished for 800,000 years, and it drew down so much carbon dioxide because it was fed by the constant, the summertime sun always being above, it had plenty of nutrients and so forth. It drew down enough CO2 to essentially lead us into our current climate from where we were 400 parts per million above CO2 above where we are now. So it was a huge, or potentially a major driver for the climate that we live in today, was the existence of this plant.
Could today's expanding marine algae change the planet, and do we know in what ways? That's a huge question, but what are your thoughts?
I think absolutely it could. The problem is a matter of scale. So if you were to sink all of the macroalgae that's in the ocean today, we've reported how much is out there. If you sunk it all today, it wouldn't make a drop. It wouldn't matter at all in the context of the overall global carbon cycling. Now, if you did it over the time frame of 800,000 years, yes, it would matter. But in the shorter term, in the timescales that are relevant for what humans are doing to this changing climate, it doesn't matter at all.
Well, just to be clear, there's not just one algae operating in similar ways around the world. Different regions develop different dominant plants for different reasons. How do you pull a meaningful pattern out of that?
Yeah, I think the broad message that we're trying to show with this paper, noting that, we have green macroalgae, brown macroalgae, floating microalgae, all of these different species, the larger Earth system is, our argument is, the larger Earth system is becoming more favorable to growth of either, these large macroalgae or of microalgae that grow at the surface. So the surface waters are becoming more favorable for growth than, say, the interior of the ocean. Because we talk about the light regime and the nutrient regime and so forth. We also, as I mentioned, we measure the in-water chlorophyll, phytoplankton. Those are also algae. So we don't see any change in what's happening in the larger global ocean as far as how much phytoplankton and so forth is in there. But we do see the surface waters changing. So the larger story that kind of connects all of these different pieces together is that the surface ocean is apparently more favorable for growth around the world than it used to be.
From the University of South Florida College of Marine Science, we've been speaking with Dr. Brian Barnes about the new paper, Global Floating Algae Blooms Are Expanding. Find links and more information to follow up in my show blog, Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Brian, thank you for sharing with our listeners.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
We are out of time. I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. A flock of gorgeous waterfowl flies above a marsh on the Texas coastline. Large and slender, they have bright pink bills and legs, chestnut necks and backs, and black underparts. Their wings flash boldly, black and white. And as they fly, they whistle. They're called black-bellied whistling ducks, and they're widespread in Central and South America. They've been easy to find in the U.S. along the western Gulf Coast and Florida, but they're also expanding northward. They've been spotted nesting as far north as Wisconsin. The black-bellied's one of 8 species of whistling ducks worldwide, in the tropics and subtropics. Whistling ducks are anything but typical ducks, to which they're only distantly related. Black-bellied whistling ducks are monogamous, and the male and female look alike. At roost during the day, whistling ducks will sometimes stand on tree branches, their long pink legs catching the sun. Late in the day, large flocks gather, then whistle their way overhead at sunset to nighttime feeding areas in fields or along the shore. A lovely and vibrant spectacle with unique sound effects. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Support comes from Wild Delight Bird Food, offering a variety of blends designed to mimic the natural resources wild birds crave. Available at Chewy.com.